So I had a conversation with some other patterns and practices people about this Avanade Microsoft framework stuff that's happening. So maybe as you go through this, you can sort of help me understand the relationship between that set of frameworks and the things that you're doing.
Okay. Well, let me just say that, you know, I've worked with the Pattern Practices Group as an independent consultant for a year and a half before I joined them. In fact, it was in a conversation on the phone that they said, why don't you think about coming to join us?
Right.
And I certainly wasn't thinking along those lines, but I couldn't think of any reason not to interview, so I did.
Right.
And, you know, it helped that I knew the people. But
well, Sandy Cound is the... is that how you say it? Cound?
Yes.
He was the Microsoft person on that other call, and then there was a fellow named Eric Blankenberg from Avanade.
I don't know Eric, but I certainly know Sandy.
Okay.
Sandy is... does a lot of our business management and a little bit of marketing, and you know, I always pass anything that I'm going to say about our group as a whole through Sandy, just to make sure that I'm saying the right thing.
Okay, so the, you know, the general concept here was that evidently Avanade has built a set of frameworks implemented as .NET classes that are exemplary in terms of best practices around, well, a variety of things having to do with enterprise development. And, you know, there's a relationship, which I still am a little vague on because it's kind of complicated, between the product that Avanade has, which is something that they're rolling out commercially after using it in their consulting practice, and some deliverable that's going to be in the next version of the Microsoft toolkit. So are you guys, is this sort of tangential to what you do, or?
It's tangential, but I, you know, I haven't worked specifically on that, but it's very close to what part of my group. When I joined the company, all of a sudden I'm paying attention to all the PAG projects instead of just the one that I've been brought in as a consultant.
Yeah, okay.
So I know something about it, and the interesting thing from my perspective is that they had a Avanade, of course, is a joint venture between Microsoft and Accenture.
Yeah.
And is very focused on Microsoft technology to start with.
Yeah.
And they, kind of as a deal closer, I think they built this this framework and had smart guys doing the architecture on that.
Uh-huh.
And then they said, well, gee, your guys are making blocks. Pretty soon you're going to make everything we have. Why don't we work together? But that was difficult because this was some intellectual property that they sold,
right?
You know, on deals, and we give our stuff away,
so, right?
There's a, you know, complicated terms having to do with you know, them getting a, you know, a first crack at everything we do, and so forth. The other thing was, but that wasn't the interesting thing. The interesting thing was that. We went through through the libraries line by line with our architects and their architects and our developers and their developers and our testers and their testers, and wrote it as what I think of as a beautiful code, using you know, the unit testing methodology, and making sure that if you read the code that it would be examples of good ways to write code on the platform.
Yeah.
Because our blocks, which is what we call our components, application blocks, are meant to be read and be reused. And so that was to see the developers on the project chose to leave their private offices and work in a bullpen environment. And I don't think that our two companies could have gotten together on what we were doing if we didn't do that. You know, it would have been, you know, I mean, every project takes some time norming, and in the norming, you know, there's lots of emails going back and forth, and when Scott Dunsmore actually said, I'm going to give up my office, I'm going to go sit in this tiny little conference room, and insisted that the other developers join him, and pretty soon the whole team's in there. Hmm. It wasn't a very pleasant environment, but it saved the project from Scott's point of view.
So how does that stuff connect with what it is that you're here to talk to me today about?
It's loosely connected in the sense that the project happened next door to mine.
Okay.
And
so maybe you should then tell me about your project.
That might be more more apropos. I'll tell you one thing that we intend, as a group, we'll do lots of different projects, and our general understanding. What our group does is help important customers, enterprise customers, succeed on the current platform.
Mm-hmm.
And when the group was founded, a lot of it was more about how to set up a data center that'll work, and it's kind of moved into the programming. And our first book of patterns was published a couple of years ago. It's available online. The second book of patterns came out recently, and that I sent the link to, and that's the Syntegration Patterns. And our approach to patterns has been to collect together the patterns that are most relevant to our customers from the community. Patterns have been, I helped start the pattern movement, 10 years ago, and a number of people have published in that area. The work that we've drawn from has been Frank Bushman and his crew at Siemens, Ralph Johnson we've worked with, and all the other people in the Gang of Four. But on top of that, a lot of work from Martin Fowler and Gregor Hopi, both of ThoughtWorks now.
Mm-hmm. Your stuff was a lot about a more abstract level of description of what these patterns were, as opposed to something that was executable, right?
Well, what we decided is we wanted. Our motivation was to help people to succeed on our technology, but we didn't want to write just about our technology. So we wrote the patterns in a technology neutral way.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, a pattern would have a implementation section that says, "Here's how to implement."
Mm-hmm.
And what we did is we left that implementation section out of the patterns. But then we would create new patterns, which we called implementation patterns, and they would have the same name as a regular pattern, but it would say implementing. I'm leafing through the book right now. Here's one. There's pipes and filters, and I think that's from POSA, isn't it?
Bushman.
And then here we have implementing pipes and filters with the BizTalk Server 2004.
Okay.
And so the first pattern really talks about how pipes and filters work, what are the forces that apply to it, why do you end up doing that. But then the implementing says, you've got BizTalk, you're doing it with BizTalk, and here's how you want to.
Okay,
but it's sometimes we'll have multiple implementation patterns to go with an abstract pattern, and that's because there's multiple ways of realizing these patterns on our technology. Now, of course, there's ways of realizing on other people's technology too, and some of our motivation for doing this, quite honestly, is we want people who are working in other technology to be able to read this book and feel at home.
And what is the title of the book that you're leafing through there?
What I'm leafing through right now is called Integration Patterns.
Okay.
And Melissa said she'd send a copy to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but it's also available as PDFs online, and I sent a link.
Yeah, I'm just getting a picture of it up in front of me so we can have it.
Yeah.
Oh, here we are. Okay. Okay.
So this, I think, is important. When we show this around other people, they say, "Wow, you guys are finally doing architecture," because it's a good way. Patterns is a great way to talk about architecture, and here we're talking about architecture in an abstract way, and then bringing it home to our product. And I think our position has been we've always had support for good architecture in our product, but in the past we've just talked about the product and not talked about the architecture.
Right.
And so our group says, let's talk to those enterprise architects in a way that they can use.
Okay, so I'm there now. This is actually all online at MSDN, right?
Yes.
Okay. Here's years, in fact.
Although, you know, patterns, for some reason, the unit of patterns is the book right now. That's what it's turned out to be. And holding it in paper is still satisfying.
Uh-huh.
So okay. If you can't wait for us to send you something, you can fire up your printer.
Okay. No, I'm just looking through
that. That's actually something that, after 10 years, the pattern community has been collecting patterns, and the fact that we have quite a number of books is a real sign of success. But it's also one of the community's limiting factors in the sense that the people we really want to reach tend not to have deep bookshelves.
Yeah.
And so our approach was to collect the most likely to be used patterns in a particular area and collect them. We don't claim a lot of originality in these patterns, and in fact, people appreciate the fact that we didn't go make our own.
I think it's probably a fair statement that patterns in general aren't intended to be original as much as they're intended to capture tried and true practices.
Exactly, it's about codification, not necessarily invention, right?
That's right. So the thing that we did to get started is we did a survey of all the artifacts that people use in the enterprise, and then how they were represented in patterns or not represented in patterns. There are some things that people do routinely that the pattern authors haven't gotten to yet.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so the other paper that I pointed to it's a short paper, and it describes the process we use for categorizing patterns. And it's the sort of thing where we had, big poster-sized printouts listing all these different artifacts. So that after working with that, I said, this is great, but somehow we have to get it down to a page that'll fit on a computer screen.
Right.
And so what I've done is I said, let's reduce all the patterns that we're talking about to a single letter or a single word or maybe just an icon. And so that we can kind of roll the mouse across the icons and sort of feel the system of patterns underneath. And so we've used this categorization to pull together a bunch of patterns. Initially, the patterns we cared about, and this is just work, how we organized our work. But we're up real soon now, probably in January, we're going to, working with the community, put together a website that is organized that way, and we'll have summaries of the important patterns.
Okay. So I see that the date on the patterns book, at least the online version of it at MSDN, is around June of this year. But the Software Factories piece, which is, I guess, what motivated this call, is just up now in November. On the MSDN library, I'm at the page with Jack's name on it, and the title is Software Factories: Assembling Applications with Patterns, Models, Frameworks, and Tools.
Right, that's the name of the title of the book. The book actually went out on the 20th of September, and I guess we have written a number of papers about it, as well as some articles.
Okay, so I've got both books here. I see. June and November.
Right.
Okay. Gotcha.
In fact, Jack and I work towards the same goals, but from different positions. What I'm about is collecting together this practice, collecting together what people do right now, and trying to get the good practices to the right people, the good techniques, so that people who don't have a lot of time to study patterns can find the patterns that apply. The other thing is, in the other artifacts we make, whether it's this the Enterprise Library or reference architectures or anything else we do as a group, what we're doing is we're going to be expert in patterns in our group, whether we make it be a pattern book or something that is just where we use that as our internal theory of production.
Right.
We want to have patterns lead to the artifacts that that we deliver. And I think where Jack and I kind of touch is that we're looking for delivery methods that are other than books.
Right.
And we think in the future that people are going to want a lot closer to where they're working. They don't want to have to reach up to a bookshelf. They want the information to come to them. And, you know, so we're working in the here and now, so we'll do whatever works right now. And I think Jack is plotting a pretty exotic future.
Well, I just noticed here that Jack was responsible for the next Enterprise Objects framework, which I guess is now Apple's Web Objects.
That's right.
Very, very cool stuff. I was checking that out back when it was a Next product, you know, and
oh,
whenever
great.
That was, the mid 90s. So what do you mean by a factory then? I mean, is that where you get to the kind of closer to the metal aspect of this?
Well, it's really the philosophy behind it. It's very much what Ward just described, which is that we want to be able to deliver guidance to users of that guidance at the point of consumption. And the idea sort of came to us, really, I guess it evolved to a large extent from our study of patterns and pattern languages. And one of the things that we observed is that there's a progression that tends to take place when one studies a particular domain and builds systems in a particular domain. And by domain, I could be talking about an industry vertical, or I could more commonly be talking about a topology or architectural style with some assumptions about technology. So say, for example, I'm building e-commerce systems. If I build enough e-commerce systems, I begin to really understand the domain well, and I begin to see not only patterns, but more coarse-grained chunks of architecture that we might call perhaps architectural styles.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we could call them architectural patterns, another word for that. So they're really sort of composites of patterns. And a pattern language of sorts starts to form, where we start to see a number of patterns that relate in specific ways. And such a language tends to sort of guide us in our thinking about how to craft certain chunks of stuff. So, for example, we have ways of thinking about how to build a UI, how to build a web UI as opposed to a thick client UI, or how to build a data access layer, things of that nature. And then what tends to happen is some of those observations over time tend to get codified into frameworks. And this is typically something that platform vendors like Microsoft tend to do, although it's also done by a number of ISVs like Siebel and SAP and PeopleSoft.
Mm-hmm.
There the emphasis, of course, is more on a vertical domain. But in either case, what's really happening is that best practices have been captured in a form that makes them a little bit, a little bit easier to apply, perhaps. In other words, less is required to some extent.
Well, a lot easier to apply because, to the extent that you can regard the .NET framework, for example, as an encapsulation of a set of best practices, it literally does encapsulate them, right? And so, I think this is the point you were getting to before, is that there's some audience out there for books that kind of describe what these patterns are and leave the implementation as an exercise for the reader, but there's a huge demand for a set of packaged components that simply encapsulate and do those things, right?
Yes, exactly. So,
now, I actually mentioned this on the other call as well, but I was at a meeting at Microsoft, I don't know, a year and a half or maybe 2 years ago, in Eric Reiter's group, and there was a concept being floated at the time, which I think was being called executable frameworks, which sounds like, to me, sounds like maybe where you're going with this idea as well, which is to say to give people things which are not, purely descriptions that are implemented as an exercise for the reader, but that do things and can be copied and pasted and modified and so on in the way that all development ultimately seems to get done.
That's exactly it. And there's a life cycle here of building systems, recognizing the patterns in systems, taking those patterns and languages and casting them as a domain specific language. and embodying that domain-specific language in what Jack's calling a factory.
Okay.
Yeah, so and just sort of to drill into that a little more, it's a great point. What happens we tend to see is that once one has a framework that embodies a set of patterns and indeed a set of abstractions, and which, by the way, is like the patterns on which they're based, designed to support variability. In other words, I expect when using a pattern to have a variety of different ways of applying it. And when I encode those patterns into a framework, I expect to have the ability to adapt and extend the framework to produce a variety of different things. I'm not producing the same thing over and over again. That's not interesting.
Right.
So, as Ward pointed out, what we've observed is that once we have a framework, we tend to find that there's a desire for tooling. Wouldn't it be nice, for example, if we could have a visual tool that allowed us to rapidly write framework completion code? If, in fact, what I do with a framework is instantiate objects, set properties on objects, make connections between objects, add some code of my own to those objects, etc., then wouldn't it be nice if I had a tool that would let me rapidly do that? And, of course, Next did that in spades. And this is a well-known sort of progression within the industry, that one can sort of go from current practice to codification of practices as patterns and documentation, to codification of practices frameworks, to finally codification of practices tooling. And we've noticed that this progression, you know, has played itself out across the history of the industry. It hasn't been quite as perhaps easy to see how to connect these dots, but I'm a compiler writer from way back, and in fact, when building a compiler, one is really doing exactly that. One is defining a language that tends to encapsulate best practices. I used to write a ton of assembly, and I used to pay a lot of attention to scoreboarding by hand, doing all sorts of things with the assembly language and setting up stack frames and so on that would really represent the best practices of the day. And, of course, what a language like, say, C did with that was to provide some abstractions that represented what at the time were sort of the best mental models for structuring the assembly language, you know, with function calls and data structures. And then that language was compiled down into the underlying code. And we see that this has happened over and over again. And with each generation, you know, the practices of the previous generation tend to be subsumed into tools once they're proven and well understood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, looking
right,
at...
Right, right. And that closes the circle, by the way. You know, the next generation starts observing, you know, as they use those tools and languages, they start observing repetition there and patterns and so forth, and that keeps the cycle working.
Right. And so I guess to make this concrete for me, because it starts to get a little vague at some point, I'm trying to just nail down. I mean, I can see how, you know, for example, if I look at the .NET framework, you know, I can point to how it encapsulates a set of what I would call best practices, you know, which formerly tended to be more hand-coded by people, right? So you can look at the caching architecture in ASP.NET, right? And it takes care of a lot of stuff that people used to have to do by hand, you know, or the, you know, the web UI aspects of ASP.NET in a similar way, right? And there's always been, in every generation of Microsoft frameworks, there's always been, you know, increasingly elaborate encapsulation of data access practices, for example, right? So, you know, those things are pretty clear to me. What I'm trying to understand, it sounds like, in various ways, people are trying to bring what I expect would be more domain-specific kinds of pattern encapsulations to the table.
The enterprise library is a perfect example of that. You might ask, why do you need an enterprise library? Why isn't the framework good enough? And the thing is at an enterprise, once you say, I'm only concerned about enterprise applications, you find that there's some generality built into the .NET framework that kind of gets in the way. And so the reason why people want to put a layer on top of that is because they want their developers to do in one statement what they used to have to take three.
Right.
And
no,
so that's a natural progression. I think what Jack is doing is he's trying to take that whole life cycle and capture that whole life cycle with tooling so that so that we go that a generation becomes shorter.
Well, that's well said, Ward. In fact, the observation, just to sort of finish out this thought of where we're going, the observation was that this has happened, you know, on the front end. We've been able to build graphical tools for manipulating UI frameworks for quite a while now. And the same thing on the back end. We've been able to build graphical tools for manipulating you know, data access and database schema for quite a while now. In fact, the Enterprise Objects framework was an embodiment of both.
Mm-hmm.
But the middle of the architecture tended to be sort of the you know, the wild outback into which, you know, it was very difficult to cast well-defined abstractions and in which people struggled for quite a while to get sort of good framework content put together. And then there's the observation that, you know, as Ward was saying, once you've done this, you can start to then build upon the languages that you have. So, for example, we wouldn't be where we are with UI if we hadn't had previous generations of UI builders from which to start reasoning about how to move up the levels of abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
However, as Ward just pointed out, there's a very interesting phenomenon that occurs here, which is that the higher up you go in level of abstraction, while you provide more value for solving a specific class of problems, for example, with Entlib, you're providing more value for solving problems related to enterprise application development than the general .NET framework provides, you're also narrowing your footprint.
Yep.
And we think that the industry is now at a very interesting juncture where in order to raise the level of abstraction much further and therefore provide much more value, we're going to start getting market footprints that are too small for the traditional model of distribution, which has been that platform vendors build out the reusable assets by and large, and end users consume them by and large with help from SIs and occasionally ISVs.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's more differentiation coming than can be sustainable in that model.
Indeed. And when one looks at other industries, one tends to see, the industries that are mature, one tends to see that this issue has been dealt with through the formation of a structure called a supply chain. Supply chains are a natural phenomenon that arise when you have complex products that essentially are developed using assemblies and sub-assemblies, which in themselves are complex and domains of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with differentiation of roles across the supply chain, where you have some folks who are building things from first principles, some folks who are assembling things into assemblies and sub-assemblies, some folks who are branding product and essentially assembling finished product from those parts, and then other folks whose job is focused on distribution, customization, delivery, installation, and so on. So our initial thinking here was, well, let's see if we can find a way to accelerate this process of going from gaining experience, building patterns, building a framework, and then ultimately ending up with tools,
mm-hmm.
and make it happen more quickly so that instead of taking, you know, 10 years for the next turn of the crank, it might happen much more rapidly and in a much more unstructured way, if you will, with lots of flowers blooming, so to speak. I know that's a dangerous quote.
Okay. Well, so,
given its origin.
So I'm looking at the supply chain chapter in your book right now as we speak, and although I am not seeing explicit references here to web services, I'm going to guess that this is just assumed that in an environment where you've partitioned out the responsibility for providing pieces of the solution and distributed that work, that the mechanism for weaving things together is going to be something like web services. Is that true?
It's a great question. It turns out that one can actually partition a factory. I haven't really given you a definition of a factory. Sorry about that. I'll do that. But I kind of wanted to sort of follow up on the opening that we had with patterns and the thinking we have around patterns and sort of show how that leads into a factory to sort of underscore the point that Ward and I are driving at the same kind of thing.
Jack's making the cycle go faster, and I'm trying to keep it full.
Yes, that's a great way to put it. So let me quickly give you a definition of what a factory is, and then I can talk about how factories can be used to form supply chains, and this will drive to this question of where web services come in.
Okay.
So the first thing to note is that if one really wants to codify knowledge and make it useful, one has to sort of do the cubby thing, if you will, and begin with the end in mind.
In other words, I need to understand what it is that people are going to do with the stuff that I give them. So that suggests a focus on producing something concrete. For example, I could identify a certain kind of application like an edge system or a transaction processing system or an e-commerce system, number of different kinds of applications that I might identify. And in general, what one tends to find is that there's a disconnect between the goal and the pieces that we give people. We give people a vast field filled with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And their question, the big question mark, is which pieces do I pick and how do I put them together to get to the specific end goal that I have in mind?
Exactly.
The hard problem.
Yeah. I only need to write one line of code, but it takes me a week to figure out where the object is that contains that line of code, right?
Yes, and exactly what to pass it. And after you've spent that week, it doesn't work the first five times through, and there's a lot more learning. So in essence, what we wanted to do with the factory was really answer that question. What do you build? What pieces are there? What best practices do you follow around each piece? How do you put those pieces together? How do they relate? And in the grand scheme of things, how does all that lead to the end goal? Can I see that all in one place? And that's the basic idea behind a factory. And the detail, there's plenty of detail, but the interesting thing about a factory for now, just to skip a lot of detail, is that one tends to have a consumer-supplier relationship between the builder of a factory and the user of a factory. In fact, that relationship is a very important one because we see that there's a sort of a natural bifurcation of roles and responsibilities that people tend to gravitate toward. Some people like building reusable things, and they don't have a lot of interest in the final delivery of a product based on those things to an end customer. Other people tend to have an interest in building end product for the customer and really don't want to spend time building reusable things. There are the few, and I think of them as the very high leverage people, who like to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, this consumer-supplier relationship is sort of one way in which a factory could be partitioned. And in fact, that kind of partitioning happens in a very broad and general horizontal sense between Microsoft and its customers. In a way, all of .NET is a very loose factory for building a certain type of application. It's really not worth calling it a factory because it's so loose. A factory tends to be much more focused.
How do you mean loose? You mean general purpose?
Very general purpose.
Okay.
To such an extent that the amount of guidance we can provide is limited, because unless we start saying, you could build edge systems, and we started to give you guidance specifically for building edge systems, you'd still be facing the challenge of knowing what to read and what to pick.
Right.
So it's very loose sort of factory. If you wanted to think of all of .NET as a factory, it's a very broad, general factory, and I'd even say it sort of falls below the threshold of being a factory. But one could also imagine very vertical factories, a factory that's designed just for, say, currency arbitrage applications, used by traders. In fact, when I was at Next, we supported folks who built exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they could quickly whack together new currency arbitrage applications out of a set of frameworks with tools designed just for that purpose was immensely valuable and enabled them to capture market windows and to make huge amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. So we've always had vertical frameworks, or I mean, always being a relative, last 10 or 15 years kind of term, but that's been a theme for a while now, right? So I'm still sort of struggling with what's different about what you're talking about here.
Well, so what a factory really is nothing new, in the sense that patterns are really nothing new. It's a codification of best practices. And the idea really is that for a particular type of system, one wants to be able to describe as much as one can about its life cycle. What kinds of requirements does it have? What kind of architecture does it have? What kinds of things do you build to put it together? How does it tend to look at deployment time? What kinds of topologies does one see during deployment?
Mm-hmm.
What best practices does one follow in building that kind of system? And one can go further and break down that broad description of a particular class of system into its chunks. If I'm working on a particular piece, like the front end of an edge system, there's specific subdomains that I can focus on. I can look at the user interaction process. I can focus on the layout of the UI. I can focus on the security aspects of interacting with the public over the internet. There's a lot of different pieces. What a software factory has at its core is a concept called a software factory schema, which is a description of a class of system that spans its life cycle and that defines the various areas of concern and separates those concerns using what we call viewpoints. In a nutshell, a software factory schema is a network or graph of viewpoints. Each viewpoint describes some aspect of building or defining or deploying or maintaining or testing a particular type of system.
Okay.
So if I have a software factory schema for, say, edge systems, which is still a fairly horizontal and general factory, I can now give very specific guidance. I can give guidance about which patterns apply when building the user interaction process, which patterns might be recommended when building the logical data design, which patterns might make sense to use when building the security elements of the UI. And I can also give information about tools. I can say, well, when you're building the user interaction process, you might want to build this using a UIP builder. And here's a UIP builder tool. And you might want to generate out to the UIP block from PAG. And when one starts to do this, one can start to get very concrete and very focused and very specific. And this is extremely valuable. My complaint with methodologies has typically been that they're very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a methodology and it says, well, you capture requirements, you do some analysis and design, you build it out, you test it and deploy it. Well, thanks, I knew that. You know, that's software development 101. What's next? So the idea here is to really try and capture that detailed guidance and to accompany the guidance with tools, patterns, templates, reusable assets of various kinds.
So I'm looking at your book right now. I see a picture of something which is labeled a software schema. Is there some corresponding description language that allows a person to, you know, write this down, and then how does that written thing get used?
Great questions. So it turns out that the language is under development. We didn't have it done in time for the book, but we're actually building one now. And this language that we're building is an example of what one finds within the factory itself. For each of these tasks that one might want to sort of automate using a tool, like laying out a user interaction process, one might cast about looking through Visual Studio and can quickly conclude that one won't find such tools there.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads to the question of, well, where do those tools come from? Well, like the tool for building software factory schemas, they're crafted as domain-specific language tools. And this is a term that we've been using. It's an approach to modeling. Here we're not talking about models that are documents that are, you know, waiting to become stale as soon as code is cut. They are active living source artifacts, typically expressed as XML, visualized as a graphical rendering in a tool, easy to manipulate, that allow very sort of agile response to change through rapid turnaround. That's the goal here, ultimately, at the end of the day, is to really sort of scale up agility and agile methods by having a whole lot less grunt work to do and having a whole lot more automation that can sort of handle some of the more rote and menial aspects of development. And to sort of answer the rest of your question there, once I have these tools, I have to deliver them into the point of consumption where the end user of the factory will actually be doing things with them. And so that leads to the concept of what we call a software factory template. It's the second major concept in a software factory. A template is an installable set of assets that deliver what the schema describes.
Okay.
And that means installing tools, installing process guidance, dynamic help, static help, creating a solution structure, typically from templates, creating project structures, creating stubbed out artifacts to be completed, all of the above. And it has a fixed part and a variable part. The fixed part is stuff that gets pre-installed once on a workstation. It represents a specific installation of a factory.
And the variable part is a part that unfolds very gradually and incrementally as we work within a factory. I might, within a factory, start out by making some decisions about my requirements, which then leads to the creation of a solution structure using templates. After having had that solution structure populated out, I might go focus on a particular project. Within that project, start building out chunks of stuff, like, say, entity classes. So I build out those entity classes. There's additional sort of instantiation of the template for me. Stubs are created. Templates are used. This mixture of the fixed and the variable portions of the template gives us both a way to sort of set out a set of guidance up front and then allow that guidance to be supplemented with very incremental guidance that allows developers to sort of drive and steer as they work within the factory.
Okay, I think I get what you're talking about. Now, to track back to the supply chain part of the discussion, this factory that you're just describing is participating with others in this larger notion of a supply chain. Is that true?
It is. So let's take, for example, the idea that perhaps some of the components that I'm going to use in building a particular type of system come from someone else.
Well, in the enterprise library example, it's Avanade, mm-hmm. and we're filling the role of building a factory, although we're doing it, you know, the old-fashioned way. But, you know, there's a relationship there that Avanade had collected this insight, you know, working with the customers, and we said, well, we're customer-focused, let's work together, mm-hmm. let's collapse this insight into a more refined product. I'm not saying their product originally wasn't refined, but we did a lot of work to refine it and organize it and document it and parameterize it. And we did that with, you know, the raw code. Now, what Jack's offering is a process for doing that. And then it will stop being our responsibility, and it'll just be done by the ISVs or maybe even a new class of a company.
That's really the end goal, in fact, Peter, is that, I'm sorry, John. Excuse me, I'm sorry about that. The name Peter Udell stuck in my head, and I apologize for that. It turns out that Ward's, you know, right on the money there. This is really a community play, an ecosystem play. And what we're really after is enabling third parties, customers, partners, to build factories and to participate in supply chains. And to get back to your B2B question, where this gets really interesting, is let's say that instead of actually consuming the components as pieces of code, we consume them as web services.
Mm-hmm.
So if I build a factory for e-commerce development, when I deliver that factory, I might deliver with it a contract to a service to be supplied by some third party, which does credit card authorization.
Right.
And one could imagine that after this has played itself out for a long time, like say 10 years, factories might become very thin. They might become shells that integrate lots of things through service composition and orchestration,
mm-hmm.
such that not only do I have a supply chain at design and development time, but I actually have a supply chain at runtime. When the application runs, various pieces of functionality are being supplied through business relationships that underlie those web service compositions.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you said, just earlier, you said participate in a supply chain. Can you just unpack that concept a little bit more for me?
Yeah, there's actually a lot to it. A supply chain is a sort of an organic thing, and like the relationship we have with Avanade, it can grow up from direct relationships between companies. But what tends to happen is that as time goes on, and one sees this in other industries, the most interesting example of this being the semiconductor and computer hardware industry, which is perhaps the most recent example of an industry going through this kind of maturity curve. What tends to happen is one moves from point relationships to public markets. So you get to the stage where multiple vendors are offering reusable components, and multiple consumers of those are bidding for those, and you end up with a very different dynamic. And for that dynamic to occur, a lot has to happen. And, you know, in the past we've seen you know, well-meaning but short-sighted attempts to bootstrap component marketplaces, there's a number of critical pieces missing, not least of which is the organizing structure of the architecture of what's being built, which in fact the factory supplies. Right, so when you have a factory for building a certain type of thing, it's well known what kinds of components need to be used and where they fit and what assumptions they're going to have to make about the environment into which they're placed. And we see service orientation as a key to making this kind of development by assembly really feasible. It's been a holy grail for 20 years at least. It hasn't worked out that well. I still remember being at Fannie Mae when Franklin Rains, who was then the CIO, asked us to create a reuse repository.
Yep.
And in those days, it was a cutting-edge concept, and of course, it was nothing but a garbage heap. Because, you know, it's very hard to know how something will be reused and when something will be reused unless one knows why.
Right.
And so the whole idea here for the factories really came from the software product lines community at the SEI, which really was starting to observe that if you stop thinking about building one thing at a time and you start thinking about building families of things, you can start to come up with some reusable abstractions and reusable architectures that provide a basis for ensuring that the stuff that you create will fit together and can be assembled. And that's something that hasn't yet been fully realized in the industry. We see this as taking a while to play out, but we're starting on it now because we think we have the right ingredients in place. And one of the most important ingredients is, in fact, service orientation. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the Indigo project?
Yes.
So you know that we're scaling down.
Yes.
And what we see useful in the service-oriented architecture is that you have richly described components, not merely things with interfaces that say what they can do, but things that also, through a richer contract, say what they require of the components with which they collaborate, that say something about the data structures and the data model of the information that's exchanged, that say something about the quality attributes that should govern the interactions, also
yeah.
as a service-level agreement.
Yeah.
Right? So once one can scale that down, one has the opportunity then to have predictable assembly from components supplied by a wide range of suppliers. We're not there today, but that's the vision.
So if I had to boil this down, you know, if somebody said, okay, in 25 words or less, you know, what did these guys tell you and what does it mean? I was just sort of asking myself that question. It'd probably be hard to answer, but I think what I'm basically taking away from this is that we've had a component-oriented approach and a framework-oriented approach, and now we're getting a service-oriented approach. And that's all part of a natural and necessary evolution. But, you know, all of that stuff needs to live in some context that makes it useful, and really what you're about here is trying to provide that context.
I couldn't have said it better, and in fact, one of the things that I love to talk about when we talk about patterns and factories is that when I look at the definition of a pattern, I suppose one might nutshell the canonical definition as a proven solution to a recurring problem in a specific context. And word is nodding, so I think I got that one right.
Yeah, I like that definition.
So the specific context was
Wait,
always...
Go ahead and say that again. That was good. Say it again.
A proven solution to a recurring problem in a specific context.
Okay, good.
The piece that was always missing for me was the context.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what a factory is doing. It's saying there's a bigger context, which is the kind of thing you're ultimately building, like an edge system, and there are many smaller contexts within it, like a particular subsystem within an edge system or a particular layer within the architecture. And now I can start to be really concrete about what those contexts are and show where those patterns might fit, as well as other pieces of useful stuff.
You know, John, when we take patterns and we assemble them into pattern languages, you know, so that when you solve one pattern, it leads you right to the next one, we're building a machine of sorts. We're building a machine that's executed by the person working with the patterns. And I think that what we're going to see is that as we get good at making patterns and pattern languages, we'll have the fuel here for the machine that Jack is talking about.
It sounds extremely appealing. I love what you're saying. It's hard, probably impossible for me to actually visualize what this would be. And I think that the challenge I mean, the interesting challenge for you guys going forward is going to be, as it probably always is in this game, is to relate these ideas to tangible stuff.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that we don't work for the same group. You know, we're there trying to deliver guidance to customers today,
mm-hmm.
and then as we look at how to do our work better and better, you know, we discover that we're working on pieces that go together.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've developed some application code that I think is going to become part of Jack's project.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And you know, so it's just this you know, if it's a little grand what we're talking about here, what it really is something that becomes apparent just by working in the area.
Right.
You know, we're driven together by being at the company here and, you know, on a project-by-project basis saying, well, you're doing that, well, that fits here,
mm-hmm.
kind of conversation. We have that conversation, you know, probably once a month. You know, well, if you're doing that, that's called this.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. And I'd add to that it is a grand vision. We set out in writing the Software Factories book to lay out a 10-year vision. That said, there are very pragmatic applications of that now, and in particular, we will be delivering the ability to create factories and use factories within Visual Studio Team System. In fact, we've already developed a down payment on that, which is, I mentioned briefly the concept of domain-specific languages, and Ward had touched on that too.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that in order to really get the kind of automation that we're looking for, we need to have some designers beyond the UI and database designers. And the question then becomes, how do you make it cheap and easy to build designers? And we thought about that pretty hard, and effectively a lot of our background comes from the UML and modeling communities. We have a pretty amazing team, actually. Alan Wills, who co-wrote Catalysis with Desmond D'Souza, Steve Cook, who developed OCL and was part of the UML from 0.7 onward, Stuart Kent, who led the Precise UML Consortium, and I guess I had a lot of involvement with it. Brand Selleck and Chris Gobrin, if you know who they are, were both direct reports of mine. Chris ran the UML2 Partners Consortium that put UML2 together, and Brand Selleck ran the finalization task force for UML2.
Okay.
From our collective experience, we basically decided to give up on UML. Why? Well, we had a lot of hopes that UML2 would turn out to be what we were looking for, and it didn't. But that said, we learned a lot from working with UML and MOF, and we learned a lot about what to do and what not to do. And at the end of the day, while UML2 didn't turn out to be what we had hoped for, we think the domain-specific language strategy is. And therefore, we've developed an SDK and a set of tools around that, which are downloadable now. And these tools our down payment, and there's going to be quite a lot more coming in the next 6 to 9 months.
Well, since I'm actually at the website, why don't you point me there now, just so I'll register with the...
Yeah, if you go to msdn.microsoft.com/vstudio/team-system,
mm-hmm.
and you should see in among the headlines something called DSL tools. I'm just going to navigate over there and make sure I'm giving you good guidance.
Yeah, yep, I see it.
You see that?
Yep.
Okay. So if you go there, you'll see that there is a community transparency project, I think it's called, or CTP, that is the project building the SDK for creating new domain-specific languages and designers that implement them. And we actually have the ability to rapidly build new designers. In fact, we can templatize an existing designer and use that as a starting point for a new one. It turns out that this is allowing us to very, very quickly build a wide range of modeling tools that, again, are not so much concerned with creating documentation, which is going to be stale, but rather modeling tools that are really manipulating source artifacts.